Hi, I'm Josh Rushing, filling in for Femi OK, and you are in the stream. Today, civilians under fire in Ukraine. As reports of deadly attacks on civilians grow, so do calls for adherence to the rules of war. We'll look at the apparent targeting of civilians in this conflict and ask, are war crimes being committed in Russia's war on Ukraine? Since fighting began in late February, Ukrainian residential neighborhoods, hospitals, schools, and buildings used as civilian shelters have endured attacks by Russian forces. Those forces have also been accused of shooting at civilians who are fleeing the war. The UN says more than 900 civilians have been killed in Ukraine. Russia denies any deliberate attacks on civilians. Today, we'll look at the issue of civilians' casualties and what can be done to prevent further loss of life. With us to talk about this, in Lviv, Richard Weir, a researcher with Human Rights Watch. In Kharkiv, Maria Adeva, a research director with the European Expert Association. And from The Hague, we have Federico Borrello, executive director with the Center for Civilians and Conflict. And oh yeah, one more person at this discussion is you. If you're watching this live right now on YouTube, see that box over there? We have a live stream producer waiting to get your comments to me so that I can get them to our audience, our panel of guests who are with me right now. I'm going to begin with Maria because you're in Kharkiv, and Kharkiv has been hard hit. Can you just give us an update on the situation and what the city there looks like right now for you?
The city is under constant shelling since the war started on the 24th of February, and the last couple of days were especially intense. So I hear the shelling non-stop day and night in different regions of the city. That means that Russia is specifically targeting residential areas because residential areas are mostly situated on the outskirts of Kharkiv, and there are mass destructions. The latest report that around 1,000 buildings was completely destroyed because of the Russian shelling. I myself went out of my house a couple of days ago and saw a cluster ammunition rocket lying just on the pavement because it didn't explode, and there were signs of these shellings all over the place. So that means that many people are now fleeing Kharkiv or forced to flee Kharkiv because Russia is deliberately terrorizing civilians, threatening them, making them flee their homes or destroying their homes and making it impossible to live there anymore because people have to hide in the underground, in the shelters. There is a shortage of food supply. And even if you go out and stay in a queue in front of the shop to get some loaf of bread, you can become easily a target for another Russian missile attack.
Hey, Maria, I want to bring in a video comment we have from someone in our community. They're with Bellingcat. This is a journalistic research organization that has been collecting what may one day be considered war crimes. Here, listen to this.
Last Thursday, we published a map that you can find at ukraine.bellingcat.com showing incidents of civilian harm and civilian infrastructure being impacted within the country. We began our collection and archiving of these incidents when invasion started on February 24th and are continuing up until present day. So far, we have over 400 incidents of civilian harm, and we unfortunately expect this number to grow as the conflict persists. When you view the map, you can filter by the kind of civilian area that's been affected, whether that's residential, such as the apartment blocks that we've seen destroyed, healthcare, such as the maternity hospital that was impacted, or childcare, such as the kindergarten that was also hit. We are archiving each of these incidents for potential justice and accountability efforts that we might see in the months and years to come.
All right, I want to show you my laptop now. I have Bellingcat's map up. Maria, I'm going to zoom in on Kharkiv where you are. And you can really, it's like everywhere in the city. You can click on these little purple circles and it'll give you photos, videos of what appears to be, I don't know, apartment buildings, condos.
That's definitely the scenes of the World War II that we now see in the Kharkiv city center, because Kharkiv survived Nazi occupation, and some of these buildings, most of them are historical buildings built before the World War II, and they survived that that period. And now they are destroyed by Russia, who says they're here to liberate and denazify Ukrainians in Kharkiv, which actually never wanted to be liberated by Russian troops. And it's especially striking because Kharkiv is a Russian-speaking city, and it was always like that. And seeing this, you know, legitimizing, so using this denazification as to legitimize this attacks on residential areas, that is something incredible. And it sort of lies out of Russian state officials and state media. That's just something you cannot believe happening.
Yeah, it's hard to believe looking at some of this destruction on my computer as you were talking. It's hard to believe you're actually in this city right now. Now, okay, there are a number of examples. There's no shortage of examples, Rich, of cities that seem to be targeted with indiscriminate shelling. I want to talk about Mariupol just for a moment because we have a theater there where it seems like in the ground in Russian they put it says children out front. Is that what this says outside the theater?
Yes, it says children, exactly. Yes,
and then Russian. This theater I'm showing now on my computer ends up being bombed. There's a bomb shelter under it. We're told about 1,300 people are thought to have taken shelter there, and we know of somewhere around 130 that have come out of the rubble so far, although we haven't seen another number. And Maria, one more for you before we go to Rich. You were just telling us a story that's breaking there now out of Mariupol. Will you share that again, please?
Yeah, that's awful news that comes right now, that there were the evacuation buses with children coming out of Mariupol, and these buses got shelled. And we don't have any numbers yet of the casualties and deaths, but there will be for sure. And the awfulness of this situation is because we do not have any connection with the people in Mariupol. Is that because Russia, when it encircles some city or town, it takes all measures to cut off any communication. So there will be no possibility to speak to the people there and get any news about what is actually happening. And that's what the case is in Mariupol. That's why we don't know how many casualties in the drama theater there are or now with these children who were in this column of buses, because Russia deliberately makes it impossible to get any data from the place. And of course, they do not want us to document the war crimes committed by Russian troops there.
Which leads exactly to why you're there, right, Rich?
That's absolutely right. And this is absolutely the case. It's very, very difficult to get information out of Mariupol. And so in order to get more information, I traveled to Zaporizhia during this period of time where several thousand residents from Mariupol who have had no contact with the world since early March, not just no contact, no water, no electricity, no heating and freezing cold conditions. And they've all described to me and my colleagues, I did about 30 interviews just in the span of a couple of days. And they just described to us, an absolute hellscape, a place under constant shelling, describing their neighbors being killed by explosive weapons as they went out to collect water or to get food or to make food because they were forced to do so on open fires. Because there's no electricity, there's no gas. And so this is an example of how awful the situation can get and is for civilians in Ukraine right now. And honestly, the fact that we don't have this information on the theater is absolutely terrifying, not just as we look at it from here when we see the devastation and destruction, but I spoke to families who left the theater just before it was attacked. And the one family in particular told me that they left their grandmother or their mother there in the theater, and they have no idea what happened to her. When I called them yesterday to ask if they had any news, they said, "We know as much as you do. All we see is what's in the news." So this information blackout makes it very difficult, not just for us to know what's going on, but for the loved ones who have been forced to leave people behind.
So, Rich, when you're documenting this, is there a distinction between documenting the horrors of war and documenting a possible war crime? Are there certain things that you have to make sure to get?
Sure, absolutely. And of course, there's no shortage of war crimes that have been sort of enumerated in the various statutes and under international humanitarian law, or what we call the laws of war. And so when we're doing this documentation, we're looking for specific elements depending on the crime. So let's, you know, intentionally directing attacks at civilians, or an indiscriminate attack, which is basically just an attack that isn't directed at anything in particular, or something like a disproportionate attack, which basically means launching an attack on something where you expect there to be excessive civilian harm, and that is excessive in relation to the military advantage gain. So these are a lot of the what we're looking at. And what I can tell you is that what we've been documenting day in and day out in Ukraine from the beginning of the war are indiscriminate attacks and disproportionate attacks, and attacks that that look like they might be intentionally directed at civilians. Although one of the really difficult things about documenting these types of attacks is trying to understand this intentionality element.
Yeah, that's exactly what I wanted to bring up, Frederico. The intentionality seems so subjective. How do you prove someone's intentions?
Yes, indeed. Short of having access to written orders by military and political leaders that direct forces to conduct attacks, you have to infer the intentionality from the evidence of what you see. And in the case of Ukraine, we've heard the numbers, you know, over 400 confirmed attacks by Bellingcat. We've seen specific cases like those you mentioned, or like the maternity ward, where the Russians have very precise weapons that they have used, and they've hit military civilian targets. In the case of the maternity war, for example, we've heard the Russian foreign minister claim that that had been turned into a military target by paramilitary Ukrainian forces. Yet he provided no evidence of that. And in fact, even international journalists who were able to get to the crimes, the two AP journalists that were there, documented the fact that there were mothers and pregnant women in that maternity ward. So short of proven through written orders, I think inferring also from past behavior, we have seen the Russian military forces adopt very similar techniques and tactics in Chechnya and in Syria, where the intentionality was clearly there to attack civilian targets. And then attacking residential neighborhoods, like Maria was saying, where there is clearly no military target nearby. That seems, again, to suggest intentionality. It is up to the Russian military to prove that in each and every single case of this, there was a military target that they were trying to hit. But it's going to be difficult when the number of attacks on civilian targets is so high.
Well, let me ask you this. The fact that Russia did this in Syria and it didn't have as big of an international outcry, does that somehow validate them doing it in Ukraine?
Well, definitely, if we have to look at one root cause of what is happening in Ukraine, is impunity. And impunity definitely for what happened in Syria, but also for what happened in Sri Lanka and in so many other parts of the world. When the wars in Rwanda and former Yugoslavia in the 1990s broke out and atrocities were committed, the international community was steadfast in creating international tribunals. This commitment to impunity, to accountability, despite the creation of the International Criminal Court, has faded. And we are seeing the results. This is the price that we are paying for the impunity that we have been seeing over the last 10, 20 years in so many conflict zones.
I want to talk about...
And Russia is...
Oh, no, please, Maria, please go.
Yeah, I just wanted to add a little on the Russian disinformation on that, because I have seen to the last days Russian officials claiming we have just saw these two women in the maternity hospital, one of which gave birth to a baby, and they are alive, both of them. And the other one that was carried out of the hospital, she later died with her unborn child. And Russian officials claim in the all over that this is one woman, an actress, and that is was all staged. And I cannot believe that kind of outrageous lies we see coming from Russian state media and the officials they are saying that, and they claim that it is the case, and not only this, but other cases of disinformation. For example, like we now see today with these chemical weapons in Sumy. So the chemical weapon factory plant was shelled during that night. So this night, actually, and there was an ammonium leakage. And Russian again say that this is Ukrainian forces who did that. So actually, there was a position in Sumy that any moment the chemical disaster might happen because the ammonium facilities were shelled during the night.
You know, we have a doctor that we want to bring in from Kyiv. Listen to this bit of sound we have.
We do our job. The question is, how is it possible today? How come the world has allowed for some people to come to Ukraine and kill our children? This is my question to you. How is this possible? What kind of animal one must be to kill children? Almost 120 children have been killed in Ukraine already, and these are only the children we know about. They do it on purpose. They drop bombs on orphanages, maternity hospitals, children's hospitals. How is this possible today?
Okay. Josh, if I may jump in, this is why documentation is so important, why the work done by People's Rights Reach is important, but also why it's crucial that the International Criminal Court, as you know, has opened an investigation. The prosecutor was very quick in opening an investigation for possible war crimes in Ukraine and has sent investigators into the country during the active stage of conflict, which is usually not the case with the ICC or the International Criminal Court. And this is ultimately one of the most important places where these war crimes can be confirmed and judged at the ICC as well as in domestic courts around the world. So everyone should be on notice. Anyone who is participating in war crimes, from the foot soldier to whoever is giving orders, can be prosecuted before the International Criminal Court. There is no statute of limitations, which means that in 10, 20, 30, 50 years, people can still be prosecuted for these crimes.
Well, I think everyone needs to hear that. Yeah, go ahead, Rich. I want to double down on what you're saying. You're saying that any soldiers can be convicted of war crimes. There's no statute of limitations, and it doesn't matter if Russia is not a member of the ICC. Every soldier at every rank needs to know they can be prosecuted for war crimes. Is that what you're saying, Federico?
That's correct, indeed. It is up to the International Criminal Court to determine which level of participation will warrant prosecution. But because Ukraine has accepted jurisdiction from the International Criminal Court, all crimes committed in Ukraine by nationals of any country in the world can be subject to prosecution at the International Criminal Court.
Rich, go.
Yeah, listen, that's absolutely correct. And it is extremely important. And it's really positive that the International Criminal Court has opened up an investigation. And hopefully this is the start of an end to impunity, not just for crimes committed by Russia in this conflict, but for all war crimes committed in any conflict. But the one thing that I wanted to add is that it's not just the International Criminal Court here who can and is looking at prosecuting individuals for committing war crimes. There's a number of different states like Spain, Germany, even Sweden has discussed the possibility of opening up investigations for war crimes committed under so-called universal jurisdiction statutes that allow them to prosecute individuals in their jurisdictions for committing war crimes. And this is a really positive step. This is where we've seen progress in conflicts like Syria and elsewhere, so that it's not just this one body, but it's multiple bodies. And the whole point of this is that individuals who commit these war crimes are not safe anywhere from prosecution and cannot enjoy impunity. And that's really important. The international community comes together and decides that they're going to abide by their obligations to find and prosecute individuals who commit war crimes.
In fact, if I may, 6 European countries as of today have said that they will open investigations into war crimes committed in Ukraine and cooperate with the International Criminal Court.
But when you're sitting...
And that is so very important to bring this information to Russian audience, to Russians, because Russia is blockading everything. They have their own information field there in Russia, not allowing any real information to come there. So that is very important to bring this all very important updates to Russian people, so they will know that if they come here to Ukraine and commit these crimes and fulfill these criminal orders and use the weapons against civilians, they will be prosecuted, and they shall know that before they have a, they do that and they commit these crimes. And Russia, for sure, is trying to cover everything up and do not give any possibility for this information to arrive to Russia. And they do not give the number, the total number of losses among their military to the Russian audience, so they will not know the truth. But that's important also to put this information there, so they will be aware of what will be in the future, and that this trial will be, and they will be responsible for the crimes.
You know, Frederico, I was just following orders. Is that a defense that will work, or is it every single person with every single trigger can be held accountable?
Yeah, unfortunately, that will not fly, in the sense that following an order that is manifestly illegal is not an excuse for anyone responsible for war crimes. So if someone is ordered to shoot a civilian and they shoot a civilian, they are complicit in war crimes, even though they have received an order.
Really great question out of our YouTube audience here. It says, how hard is it to prove the civilians were targeted versus collateral killings in warfare when trying to prosecute potential war crimes? Rich, can you jump in on that?
Yeah, I mean, we touched on this a little bit briefly in the show earlier. It can be difficult to prove intentionality, right? So this is the culpable mental state is the sort of the lawyer speak of it. But, you know, Federico talked about this, which is, how do we get to that without specific orders? And, you know, one of the ways that we can get to that is to infer it by the conduct of forces in various areas. And this is something that we, in fact, did in Syria as well. It was the repeated targeting of civilian objects, such as hospitals, using things like precision-guided weapons or highly accurate weapons that makes it clear that they hit what they were intending to hit. There is not these weapons are so accurate that it wasn't a mistake. And so we can take that kind of information and use that to support the inference that it was an intentional attack.
Yeah.
I want to share something on my computer real quick and come right back to you, Frederico. This is from Peter Maurer. He's head of the ICRC. He is in Kyiv at the moment, and he has a pretty good thread here. I'm going to retweet this. This will be at Josh Rushing. But he talks about what needs to happen to protect civilians moving forward. It says concrete agreements that would allow safe passage out of cities like Mariupol, to allow humanitarian aid in, to ensure that those who aren't part of the fight are protected. It's a long list that kind of goes on and on. Frederico, what are the odds of us seeing the Russian military take these kind of steps moving forward?
Well, unfortunately, from what we are seeing, it doesn't look likely. However, since the Russian military and government continue to say that they are not targeting civilians, these are precisely the kind of actions they can take to prove that they are not targeting civilians, allow safe evacuation, allow safe passage of aid to civilians, stop using weapons like dumb bombs and cluster munitions that used in densely populated areas will inevitably harm civilians. Short of a ceasefire and a peace agreement, which is the only thing that can stop this bloodshed, these are concrete steps that can show a true willingness to spare civilians.
You know, it's nothing new, civilians being the ones who suffer the most in war. It seems like that's the way it always works out. It's good to know that we have people on the ground documenting these things as best they can, like some of our guests today. I want to thank all of our guests for being with us today, and thank you for being a part of the stream. And for the whole crew here, well, we'll see you tomorrow.